We begin the fifth class in our series. And again, we'll begin with a 30-minute meditation in which I will review the instructions up until this class, and then we will add another dimension of instructions to it. So each week we sort of expound upon and review what has been, but also add something new to our meditation experience for that week. It's not that I expect you to sort of get it all. I just want to make it a complete practice for you by the end of the 6 weeks, and it's going to require an ongoing commitment to the practice for it to, in some ways, sink in and become really integrated. At first, it's a little bit like trying to be a crane operator and knowing what lever to push and pull at a particular time. And over time, it becomes very intuitive as to what you need to do in terms of your meditation and what instructions you need to follow. For instance, just the mind is very discursive, and for most of us here in the room, we only know a discursive mind, so it's not as if we've seen the other side of that, which is a quiet mind. But at some point, it does quiet down. However, no matter how quiet it becomes, at sometimes it gets noisy again. And so then you apply a particular one-pointed focus on the breath, perhaps when it's very noisy. And when it becomes more settled and more composed, you can move out to other objects, bringing that sense of steadiness and clarity to each object as it arises. So not to worry about this. As the practice unfolds, it unfolds in a very natural and organic direction. All we have to do is put in the effort to make that practice grow. And that effort is the willingness to come back to the experience rather than to the conceptualization of the experience where we spend most of our time. So if we could take a erect posture, unrounding the shoulders, relaxing the shoulders away from the neck, but keeping the shoulders open, both symbolically and actually allowing the posture to be open is a receptive stance, saying internally, whatever comes, comes, it's okay. Not trying to protect or defend ourselves from any aspect of our inward experience. Now, we're not sitting down in meditation to task, to construct, or to complete anything. It's really, the idea of it is to see what's going on. So if there's a right attitude to meditation, say, let me just look at what's going on here. Let me see what's going on inside of myself. And that right attitude is very important if the meditation is to uncover and deepen on its own. If we set out to construct or form a task, we will really be using our old mind to try to uncover our spiritual lives, and all the old mind will uncover is the same problems from whence it has come. So it's the new attitude is very important to instill. Let me just see what's going on here. Not try to change it, distort it, judge it, own it as being mine or me, but just see, just to hold within the expanse of our sight, inward sight, awareness. Just what's going on, just what's there, to be able to see it and allow it to come and to go, which of course all phenomena do. And so we started this process 5 weeks ago by focusing in on one physical sensation that is there as long as we're alive, and that's the sensation of breath. And we rest our attention upon that breath with ease and relaxation. And throughout the entire series of instructions, I've emphasized the sense of relaxation, the sense of ease, because it's the tension that indicates that a problem has occurred. And when we can look at our life and look at our internal life, our emotional life, our thoughts, our physical sensations, not as a problem to be solved, but as something to just allow, we need to have a base in relaxation in order to gain a foothold into that allowance. So relaxation is extraordinarily important throughout this meditation. And then we moved on to other physical sensations besides the breath, so that if a difficult or unpleasant sensation like pain or an itch should arise, we can take our mind off the breath and bring the same degree of care and attention that we were giving the breath to this competing sensation. Again, just seeing what's there, allowing it to be there, not waiting for it to end so that I can go back to the breath, but just allowing its own life to be lived, its own time to be observed. And then when it does become less intense or less predominant, returning to the breath. We also opened up to the whole range of emotions within us, be they pleasant or unpleasant emotions like irritability and annoyance and frustration and anger, or joy, happiness, bliss, contentment, well-being. We can feel those completely, intimately, without ownership or judgment, to be very fully connected so that the emotions don't lead to a reaction in which we are then acting the emotion out, but rather to be able to hold and abide in the emotion completely, but fully clearly, so that we give it space to be, and in so doing it does not create a tension or an irritability within us. And also we opened up to the five hindrances, which we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. And those hindrances in review are strong patterns, which when they do come into our mind, come in with such a conditioned reference that we find ourselves acting out those patterns very quickly unless we know they're occurring. The secret weapon in meditation is to know that they are arising, that we bring them in front, put them on our lap, rather than have them behind the scenes in a shadowy form. And what are those five hindrances? The first hindrance is wanting, the sense of craving inside of ourselves, the sense of neediness, looking outside our experience for something to pull in that would make it more enjoyable, perhaps. The second hindrance is aversion or not wanting, the pain in the knee, something, some aspect of our experience that we'd rather eliminate. The third hindrance is restlessness or worry or agitation, a kind of bubbling sense of physicality which creates a kind of biting at the bit mentality. The fourth is sleepiness, sloth, torpor, dullness of mind, lethargy of spirit, that sense of dullness, that boredom which hits us. Just to know that that's occurring. And the fifth, and perhaps most devastating, if it's not attended to, is doubt. Mostly self-doubt in our abilities to actually do this practice. Questioning those abilities. So when those hindrances arise, to note them, to see, okay, they're here. And then to allow whatever physical expression they have to be observed, whatever mental components might be arriving, to let those also be at hand, and to notice that they also have a timing. They come, they stay for a while, and they go. They're not of very long duration. If we don't feed their appetite by believing in them and identifying with them, they're very limited in nature. And so we don't fix ourselves in reference to anything. And so the meditation is very much non-fixation, not claiming ownership to anything, but allowing the stream to pass in front of us, continually to move. As soon as we take ourselves out of that stream and say, oh, I'm such an angry person, I don't know why I have so much anger, we've essentially frozen that stream, claiming that only one aspect of that stream is who we are. Rather to drop the who we are and just to witness the stream of events as it goes through us in a very settled and relaxed manner, always from a point of view, the base or the foundation or the bed of the stream is relaxation. Last week we included sound as another component of our experience, to just be able to hear without being annoyed as to what we hear. The annoyance doesn't come from the hearing, it comes from the interpretation we give to the hearing. At that point, we're no longer hearing, we're opinionating what it is that's being heard. We're concluding, and we're objecting to the conclusion. Oh, that person shouldn't be so noisy, why are they so restless, and why are they doing this? Rather than just listening to the sense of hearing itself. So sometime when you're walking down the streets of whatever city you're from, see if you can walk with that sense of just listening without becoming constricted or constrained by what it is that you hear. And you'll find that listening is a venue, is a environment in which the mind can be very spacious and open. In fact, it's often helpful to start the meditation, once we are on the breath a little bit, then open to hearing. And hearing allows that sense of tensionless relaxation to be imbued within the practice itself. And then going back to the breath. And then when the mind gets lost in thought, before we come straight back to whatever competing sensations may be occurring, we first open to the sense of general relaxation through hearing, and then coming back again to the physical sensation or emotion or whatever it is we might be looking at. This week we're going to open the field of our attention to include the whole range and presentation of mind itself. Thoughts, beliefs, attitudes, opinions, conclusions, the whole range of different strategies that the mind fixes upon to conclude about the world through thought. Thought is the foundation, is the brick and mortar of these attitudes and beliefs, etc. The all-important difference between being lost in thought and meditating upon thought is knowing that you're thinking, knowing that thinking is occurring. Remembering that the definition of meditation is knowing what's occurring. For the most part, early on, it's very difficult to know thinking is occurring. In order to make the process a little easier, I recommend staying with the physicality, the physical sensation, rather than to try to move off into seeing if you can hear your thinking. It's possible as the practice actually moves and becomes deeper and stiller, quieter, that you'll be able to hear the thoughts as they occur. But for now, let's just know whether it is that we're thinking or not when we are thinking. And whenever we realize we are thinking, be willing to give it up and to come back to a more grounded sensation like the physical body. So we're beginning now to get a sense or an orientation to what the mind is doing and to know what the mind is doing as it's doing it, rather than to be lost in thought for 10 minutes and then pull ourselves out 10 minutes later at the very beginning of the thinking process. Oh, I'm thinking. Okay, let me just let that go and come back to the breath or the competing sensation. So staying very simple and quiet, relaxed and at ease. And now we'll sit for 15 minutes and I'll be quiet. Ending the meditation with the poem "The Journey" by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundation, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. May all beings take responsibility for their pain. May all beings take responsibility for opening their heart. May all beings take responsibility for making their lives work. So you're welcome to stand up and stretch and grab a homework sheet if you didn't pick one up. Tonight we opened up the field of our attention to include something that has always defined us, and for us to even include it in the meditation feels very slippery and unsure, because we have decided to begin to observe or know that we are thinking. Now that's an extraordinary, extraordinary task to take on, because we have defined ourselves and our whole life by our thoughts, have we not? And we hold ourselves in advantage or disadvantage by the thoughts that occur, and often are plagued by the thoughts or exhilarated by them. But to think for a moment that these thoughts may be another conditioned product or process of the mind is extraordinary, to take that on, to actually consider that possibility. And yet the first time we sat down in this meditation, it became obvious that there was more to thought than you're just thinking it. Because, in fact, what was the difficulty? What was the immediate insight about our thinking other than, I have no control over this? I mean, I'm given a very simple task to do, which is just to follow my breath. And the mind does everything but that simple task. Now, why is that? If I indeed had control over my thinking and could place my attention on something and just say, okay, mind, be quiet now. Since I'm the thinker of the thought, I release yourself from the job of thinking, and now I will just notice what it is that I'm attending to. And yet we can't do that. No matter how hard we try, in fact, the harder we try, the less we can do it. Which is why I keep suggesting relaxation. There is, if we take that, just that observation, there is depth, spiritual depth, to that point. And that point will keep showing itself in richer and richer meaning as the meditation deepens on its own. There's a book that whose title is appropriate. It said, thoughts without a thinker. Thoughts without a thinker. In fact, the thinking process is just a series of neurons firing. Given a stimulation, given a particular reference, a conditioned reference, these thoughts fire. And as the practice deepens, a wonder will transpire in which we will actually be able to hear the thoughts as they arise, in much the same way as you are listening to me hearing my speech. It will be in your own tone, but it will be like words from a radio in your room that you've left on and can't unplug. Now, because this constant reference, this conditioned reference has been made to each and everything in the world, so that when my eyes light upon something, that stimulation of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, etc., activates the field of memory, so that then that thought occurs that's associated with that particular discriminatory object or generalized field in which I am looking. And therefore, I'm constantly, when I look out with my eyes especially, seeing the concepts that are at the other end of the thought, not the actual form that is being initiated prior to thought. And so too, in each of our sense doors, there is the moment in which the senses are come into the mind, and then what the mind does in terms of translating that data is the all-important difference between meditation and abstract thinking. Why is it that we want to stay on our breath as opposed to thinking about things? It's because thoughts are one step removed from the actual experience of life in its purest form, which is where the data comes in, the actual moment that the data arrives. We don't think that we can live that close to things, so we decide, for safety purposes, to make everything secure and known to us, to take up our life after the thought process has ensued. So after everything is determined and located, then we come in. And we say, oh yeah, of course. The problem with that, if you just look around the room, is that nothing is unknown. And if something is unknown, it's labeled unknown, and therefore known in some sort of way. But no sense of the edges are all defined when we live just according to what our mind depicts something to be. And then we live in a very narrow corridor of just what that concept says to us about that particular object. And what the mind says to us about that object is what we have learned about it from the past. And therefore, there is really nothing that is gleaned, nothing that is newly acquired in most of our perceptions of life. Rather, it's just the same old memory coming back in new circumstances to navigate through the world in ways that I won't collide or cause conflict for myself, etc. And what we're doing in meditation is something diametrically opposed to that style of life. In fact, that style of life, content-based life, which is what we have been living, I believe now the evolution of human beings, the evolution, is moving out of content-based. It has to. Because look at the circumstances, look at the tragedies, look at the situations that content-based life has produced after as many centuries as we've been around. And whether the human being can survive another 100 years based upon content-based life is very questionable. And so what we're beginning to see is people attending classes such as these and many, many others in which they're looking for some more fulfillment in life, something richer, something more profound, something that invites a fuller component of living, a fuller and more total living experience within it. We're looking for our hearts to be engaged. That's what we're really looking for. We're looking for some intimation of life in its completion, in its wholeness. Because content-based life will always fracture the field of perception by its knowing particular objects. When I know something and many things, my object is well served by my knowing and security, but what I've done is fractured the field into many, many, many different things. And in the inspired religious texts, they talk about the oneness of things. Where does oneness come from? Certainly not from perception of multiplicity. There cannot be oneness when I constantly reaffirm life as being this and that, but rather in my ability to relax and allow the pieces to come back into some sense of wholeness. So what we are doing in meditation is quite exciting, actually, if we have the courage to do it, because now you're really stepping into unknown territory. You've never gone this way before. And that is, at its core, the core issue there is fear. Fear has held us and maintained the content relationship with things. Because when I know something, I'm not afraid of it. And the more things I know, which is why we applaud knowledge, somebody who knows a lot, and opinionation, somebody that had perceived and opinionates and concludes about something, we hold that because it holds fear, or seems to hold fear, at bay. Everything is exactly as it's perceived and not distant or different from. So now we're entering the room of our mind, coming back into that metaphor, if I could, to bring you back into what we've been talking about, in which our mind is also fractured into multiple problems. I mean, I have an emotion over here that I absolutely can't stand within me, and I have a sense of idealism that I need to move across this space to some other part of the continuum where I can be happy. I search for happiness in here, and momentarily I may find some feeling of happiness, but then the whole thing moves off again, and my mind captures or thinks about what it used to have and tries again to create those very mental states that have so disappeared and have been so fleeting. And I spend my whole time annoyed with the content of what's in here, thinking about what I would really like to have in here, which is happiness, peace, tranquility, and calm. And I search for them, and sometimes in a fleeting moment they arrive, and then they pass, and I go, oh, how can life be so disappointing? I must have done something wrong, or the situation changed. If I just create the same situation and hold myself in a particular way, I can regain that sense of contentment and happiness once more. And maybe it was the old boyfriend I had 15 years ago, or the job I... And we, at some point, absolutely have to lay down that burden of pursuit, because that burden of pursuit is what the memory is telling us was there. It's all based upon what has been, and our memory having tried to follow the yellow brick road back to those same products that were so full of excitement when they arrived the first time. Now, is there another way? And what the meditation is encouraging is that we go into this room not with the self-improvement mode, not thinking that it isn't okay just as it is. How can it be okay? With my lust, with my greed, with my passion, with my rage? Yes. 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 Just there. Just that. Just that. And then immediately when you say just that, you're no longer longing for an ideal other than that, which isn't in this room. The ideal isn't here. It's in your mind's memory, but not here. Not in fact. The only thing in fact is what is in fact there. That's what's in fact. And if the rage is there, then the rage is there. then my ability to hold that rage without creating divisions from it by forming an ideal that's pitted, the ideal is against the actual, the reality. The ideal is created by my thoughts of memory in opposition to what is actually occurring. So the whole thing is fractured open. It's not this that's okay, it's where this will eventually lead so I can get back to this. If I drop this, then this has to be okay. And in fact, it is okay. It's just the thought that tells us that it's not. So I look at my fear, I look at my rage. I don't allow it to gain advantage through my unconscious. I'm conscious to it. It's not behind the scene pulling the levers. It's out front so that I can see it. Okay, I've got it. There it is. It's right there. Okay, I can allow that now. And the allowance is the space for it to come and for it to go, which it will do. And in fact, I stopped looking for happiness as a state of mind, because happiness as a state of mind, like all states of mind, are ephemeral, in transition, cannot be reproduced, cannot be fixed, cannot be secured. Where happiness comes in is in my willingness to release myself from the idea that happiness is other than what's immediately here. And when I fully release myself into that, so that I'm not looking in even the slightest intent to create another here as opposed to this here, another reality which has to be abstract, because if there's one reality, there's not two. So as the moment that I allow myself to release myself completely without any edge to it at all into this reality, happiness arrives, because there is wholeness. There is the whole. The lights come on in the room. There is wholeness. There is stillness. There is a world of thoughtless awareness. Thoughtless awareness. Just feel for a moment as we speak, because sometimes the words can pull us into the space of thoughtless awareness, if you're willing to come. And you can feel or intimate or sense what this could be like. It's not fearful. It's full, rich, vitally awake. In which everything is seen. It's not as if I start bumping into walls because I don't think. Things are seen, things are known, but thought informs the situation rather than directs the situation. I know who you are, I know who I am, I know where I am, but why does it have to lead to tension, constriction, and fear? The other quality that we are aspiring towards, and I say that not as a goal, but as a claim on reality itself, is the sensitivity of heart. The sensitivity of heart, where you're actually feeling life up close and intimate. Intimate. Rather than objectifying it. There, in Plato's Republic, he uses the metaphor of a cave in which there are a line of people all chained together, and they can't turn their heads to see each other. And behind this line of people is a fire, and the fire is casting this line of people's shadows on the wall of the cave. And everybody relates to to their fellow people by thinking that the shadows are who they are, because they can't turn to see that there's anyone on their right or left. And someone frees themselves enough from the chains to turn around to see the fire behind them, to realize that the fire is what's creating the shadows, and that the people are far different than the shadows represent. And he tries to tell the other people in the line that, in fact, they are different than these shadows, and nobody wants to turn their heads. Do you know, in the New York Times study, 50% of the population have had an experience of wholeness, what they call a mystical experience, or a feeling of expansion, or maybe, depending upon what words you used, a touch of God. And of those 50% who have had that experience, 80% say they never want that experience again. Because it shook the apple cart. It created too much dissonance. They would rather stay on the safe side of life than the exploration of what we're taking on here. This is not easy. Let us not disparage that 80%. Quite likely there is part of us within that 80%. When we go into our minds, we're going doing something as revolutionary as we possibly can. We are not looking for Western psychology for our understanding of what is here. We're not looking for anyone. We are or any explanation. We are looking through the lamp of our own attention, through our own ability to discern and see and to experience, not by what it is that we think about something, because then it would be unreliable. It would just be my past memories and associations placed upon the present situation. That's unreliable. So I let all the thoughts and conclusions go and actually make direct contact with it. Seeing it. Just that, without judgment. And then it is reliable because it's awareness in its purest form, without any discoloration whatsoever. And when we are up close and intimate to such a refined degree, what happens is our heart opens. Our heart has been kept in abeyance by our conceptualization, our abstraction. How can abstraction ever allow for sensitivity, for ever allow for contact with the real thing? Just let it make sense to you, you see? You look at a rose and you say, I've seen roses. There's no sensitivity in that. But if you look at a rose and see it as the only rose, then the mind isn't interfering and the heart responds to it, you see? Where wholeness, all the things we most want in life, all the things that your heart yearns for, wholeness, completion, love, intimacy, whatever your contentment, rest, comes from our willingness to be vulnerable, to be open and exposed, so that life can touch us completely. And the reason, again, we don't is because we put a layer of fear between ourselves and that life. We've been hurt, we've been scarred, and somehow those scars have created a kind of defense, a pullback, sort of enclosed defensiveness. So we lead with our defenses against the world, and we are loath to come out like a turtle that's retracted into its shell. We're loath to stick our head back out again. But now we're adults. We're not small children anymore. Perhaps those defenses had purpose at some point to survive. But now, as an adult, we can pull out again. We can test the waters. We can come up against life and to feel it. And no matter whether people take advantage of that degree of innocence or not, it doesn't matter, because the component experience that also grows with us is our capacity to hold pain. If somebody says, "You're a fool for doing that meditation," and we're particularly full of self-doubt and self-recrimination, that sense of foolishness may resonate somewhere, and we go, "Oh, okay, let me just hold that feeling." Instead of recoiling with it and allowing a whole transcript to unfold about how foolish we've been our whole lives, and this is just another indication of our foolishness, we don't go that way, because that's just the way of thought. That's the way of insane thought. So there is rational or sane thought and insane thought. Sane thought sees just what is there. Okay, I'm in a room, 60 people. Insane thought, somebody gets up and leaves. Oh, they found me out. They know I'm the fake I think I am. They've gotten up and leave, and it's all about me. And God, what am I going to do? Maybe I should run after them. Okay, so you put your situation. You laugh, but you put your situation in there. You break up with your boyfriend, your girlfriend, you lose your job. Somebody honks at you. Somebody says a crossword. Insane thought. We just, given the right situations, this stimulus arises, this cause and effect. This is what comes out of our mind. Our mind gushes forth. It waits to gush forth, especially around our weakest areas, which are our neurotic areas. You begin to mistrust that. Genuinely mistrust your thinking. Because 99.9, and I'm giving it some, is insane thinking. It has nothing to do with anything except our projections of fear and self-distortion. Get a feeling for this. You see what we're doing in here? I lured you in, and for the first 5 weeks, I fed you biscuits. Now we're coming into the real stuff, which...
wine and cheese?
Which hopefully... you will pursue for the rest of your life. If not in this form or this tradition, it doesn't matter to me whether you stay within the insight meditation tradition or whether you don't. But this has to evolve. We have to move out of this content-based perception of life if we're ever going to move into the heart. And if the world isn't calling for the heart now, when will it? Let me just give you another indication of how insane thought is. All of time, T-I-M-E, time, is contained in thought. All of the bondage, the remorse, the shame, the burden of your decades is just self-referencing something that has long since been over through thought, thinking. Your future aspirations, goals, ideals is a projection from this moment into an abstract reality. Through thought. Understand thought, you understand time. Release yourself from thought, you have released yourself from time. No more shame, self-recrimination, self-abuse, doesn't mean you lose the ability to move towards a goal. You set a goal for yourself and you stay here and meet what the first step is in that goal. Not to worry 10 steps up about how tragic it's going to be if I miss step two. You stay focused and grounded. Just to get a sense of how driven we are by time. And that time is just, I mean, where is time? Please show me the past. Bring out your albums if you wish. But to me, that album is here and now. It has nothing to do with the past. But you don't understand. No. I do understand. You see, we're always living in the only place we can live. The only vortex of where the past and future cross is the immediacy of here and now. That's where the two... We're always there. It's just that we're constantly referencing a different point through our mind. We have a sore knee. Oh, I can't wait till this sitting is over. The sitting isn't over. But we can't wait until the moment comes when the sitting is over, which is a future expectation, a future time that is much more appealing than this time. So I leave this time in which my knee is hurting and I go to the time when it will be over. And then I hold on to that. I put the life of myself into that. And of course, that is going to create conflict with this. Because in fact, the knee is still hurting and the sitting is not over. So we have run ourselves, we have created the problem mentally and then run headlong into it. Put every single disappointment, regret into that equation and you begin to immediately see the destructive quality of thought. So you say to yourself, but I thoughts created Nobel Prize winning and all the I would suggest something else. The Nobel physicist said that he had been working on this particular problem for some time and had just been at loggerheads with it. Gave it up, said he was going to go down to the beach, and he was just walking along the beach, his eyes lighted upon the shell, and at that moment he understood the equation that he needed to understand. Einstein said, quote, "I did not understand the fundamental laws of the universe through my rational mind." In fact, he said he became a light beam. That's how he understood how a light... I don't know how you do that. That's not where... Creativity is seeing something new in a new perspective, in a new way. That comes from stillness. That comes from quiet. Not from the noise of thought, because thought can only see through the words and concepts from which it has always known that reference. To see something new requires stillness, quiet. Then what happens is that seeing, this is called insight meditation, and this is what insight is, seeing something new. It's also creativity. Or whatever koan practice in Zen is this. Then after that is seen, what happens, the mind very quickly catches that's turned into an idea and then it elaborates on that idea. But the actual seeing itself was not from the process of thinking. So what happens when we sit in meditation is at first we're immersed in the content of our lives because that's all we know. We sit quietly, and why did I say that to him? And what's the matter with, oh, God, I've got to go back, and oh, wow, I've got so many things to do today. Why am I sitting here like this? And the content of our life just comes flooding in because that's how we have encouraged life to be. We have made life into content references, okay? So that for everybody, when we sit down, that is what's going to happen when we sit quietly. The content of our lives, because that's what we have formed life to be, comes back in. And then, maybe after a while, as you keep taking yourself out of the content, coming back to the experience of your breath, back to the experience of just the senses as they are being felt, seen, smelled, taste, just what is, slowly what you begin to do is change the content into processes. What has up until this point just been content-lated thinking, now we begin to see processes of mind. The thinking itself is a process. And I'm thinking, okay. It's not so much what the content of the thought is about, but just the fact that thinking is occurring. Okay, thinking. Okay. Emotions. It's not so much where the content of the emotion lies, why you're angry, the explanation for your frustration or your happiness, but rather that emotions just are like the ticker tape of the stock market. They're just coming and going, and you just, okay, emotion, all right, emotion. And you begin to get a sense that the stream of events is just a stream of events. And that we have laced these streams of events together to create our meaning, to create our purpose, to create our posture. And so when we open our eyes from our sitting, and if this hasn't happened to you, it will if you continue, the first thing that the sense of me wants to do is to gain back its empowerment. Because when you're sitting, you don't know what you are. I mean, you aren't as well formed. So have you ever noticed, oftentimes you'll go right to the record player, disc player, right to the radio or the refrigerator, open up something to stimulate the desire, and to get you back grounded again, to get the thoughts back working, to get your life back in terms of content. I'll call somebody on my... Right? Watch. Not very frequently do we just stay quiet, unformed, simple. The whole sense of you and I comes from the equation, from the emphasis, from the reinforcement on content. When content is allowed to release itself into the processes of life, we are not so well defined. And that, more than anything, scares us. We want to be well defined. I'm losing myself. But as we touch quiet, just being quiet here, feel what quiet feels like in terms of who you are. It's not very well defined. See, we need a rub in order to be defined. We need an edge. And content creates a rub. It's my this and your that, and I'm resisting this and I'm attracted to that. Those are all rubs. That's how we know each little component border and seam of our bodies and our personalities and our character. But when we release ourselves from that kind of tension and resistance, something else wakens, our heart and our mind expands, but we lose a very definitive self-reference. And so we try to come back into self-referencing by adhering back to the content. Oh, I know you. Hi, how are you? Yep, great. Yep. I have a terrible day today. Terrible day. Stomach hurts. I just had it. Why not just explore being quiet? Why all this hyperbole? Why all this? About what? About thinking. About creating ourself around thought. Why not just be the stillness, which is much more of our reference than the noise? Why not allow that possibility to unfold? See what it's like. See if it doesn't bring forth everything you most wished about yourself and for yourself. So it's not a small thing we do. Think about when you're going to die. How much of your content is going to matter to you? I've been with dying people for 16 years. I've never heard one of them complain on their deathbed about not having worked hard enough, not having accomplished more, needing to have gone back to work and begrudging the time they spent with themselves or with those who they loved. I should have been more of a workaholic. Never have I heard that. Never have I heard someone say, I'm going to miss my Mercedes. Never. Not one time. We can't take any of that with us. None. What can go through the eye of the needle? Stillness. Quiet. Everything else is like a thread that just... Those of you who are sewers know what I'm talking about. So we're seeking out that quiet. We're seeking out the methods that lead to a more genuine, stable, sane existence. Without the hyperbole, without the drama, without the need to constantly create myself moment after moment through my resistance, my antagonism, and my annoyance. Can we sit for a minute or two? We're back from the walking period and an opportunity now to ask questions or comments about whatever you might wish to do that. Remember that next week is our last week together before the day long, and it's a very important session, so please don't miss next week. I kind of bring it all together. I give you resources that if you would wish to continue this practice, I direct you in those ways. I give you a book list of kind of the essential few. I give you some details and some I try to bring the whole thing together. And then, of course, the final meditation together as well. Then, of course, we'll have the day-long over at Bastyr on the 26th of October. And that'll be sort of the culmination of the whole time together. Homework for this week. Continue to sit 30 minutes a day. Add yourself a fifth marker. And again, I'd like at least two of those markers to be when you go to bed, following your breath into sleep, and when you wake up, taking a couple of minutes before you jump out of bed and just establish some sense of care and attention to your body and to your mind before you do that. So if you haven't established those two markers, please start establishing them. And the homework sheet that I gave you. And finally, I'd like you to take a two-day news fast sometime during the course of this week. Not listening to public radio, not watching television news, because I don't think we realize how it instills a kind of tension within us. And I'm not trying to get you so that you aren't aware of what is occurring in the world, but rather for you to be able to see what are the components of the kind of tension we hold. What is it that we keep shoving into ourselves? Because we hold a kind of, I mean, especially in these times, kind of a fear base in which we bring the news in. So just take a couple of days. You can take it two straight days or two other, you know, you can do a Monday and a Wednesday or something, whatever you want to do. But just for that day, don't allow yourself to turn on newscasts. Take a two-day news break. So questions or comments about anything? Yes.
Well, first it's kind of a joke, but what do you do if you already are the news staff? How do we hardship ourselves? Should we watch the news for 2 days? Anyway.
No.
One of my teachers says, how would you feel if you didn't have that thought? Like, what? How would you feel right now in that moment if you didn't have that thought? And I just, when he said it to me, I didn't really relate until tonight's lecture, where I was like, oh, okay.
Another way of doing that is to say, is this true? Question your thought. Is this true? And don't just fall, well, yes, of course, it's always been true about me. And, you know, if you could look inside of me, you could see it was true too. Right? That's one level that you can answer that question. Or you can really say, what is true about it? It's a feeling. I can hold that. It's a bunch of thinking that has nothing to do with really anything. Where is there any truth in it? And the thought won't last from that kind of surveillance, that kind of sincerity. What is true in that?
Does the knee pain eventually go away, or do I need to find a new position?
Does the knee pain finally go away, or do you need to find a new position? Regardless of what posture you take, there will be pain associated with it, because the ligaments and the tendons are stretching, and we haven't spent a half an hour in any one position probably for our whole life, and yet we're asked to do that now. So there's going to be pain, some pain, until the body properly accommodates to that new position, and that may take some time. But even after it accommodates to the position, then there'll be other kinds of pain that arises. So it's not that we're trying to escape pain, but trying to allow pain, not masochistically, but completely into our lives, so that it isn't a tension. Not that we can put our hand under a flame and not move. It's not that kind of asceticism. But rather that we start looking at sensations that occur as being pleasant and unpleasant. And that the strategy of running from the unpleasant and trying to bind ourselves to the pleasant creates the kind of tension and division inwardly and outwardly that we see for ourselves now. So when something unpleasant comes up, is it possible for me to say, okay, let me feel this fully. Let me not resist it. Let me just say yes to it. Some pain you won't be able to, because it'll be too strong and too intense, which is fine. You move. There's no failure. You're not to blame. You haven't been a poor meditator because you weren't up to the task. Just let all that go. That's just thinking. And then start again. But there will be many times when sensations are unpleasant. An itch, a noise, sights, sounds, smells, tastes come in a variety of packaging. Unpleasant and pleasant. Okay. If I pull away from one and try to create a universe in which unpleasant do not exist and there's only pleasant. Well, Dorothy tried to do that by leaving Kansas. And she found witches. It is impossible. Yes. Right. Yes.
Is it a good idea to correct once I notice
that? The question is, she feels herself bending over and being unable to maintain an upright, open position during meditation, and should she correct that? I would keep a very strong body focus. So I would leave my breath and just be with the body, and as soon as the arms start moving, okay, first of all, get a sense of what's happening there. Quite likely, one of the hindrances are coming. Could be fear and you're trying to protect yourself. Could be sloth and torpor where you're moving into kind of a drowsy state. So you want to acknowledge what's going on that's driving that new posture or taking you out of the open posture. And you also want to create, so you know the motivation for why you're moving, but you also want to keep the posture open. So if you did nothing but reference your posture through the whole sitting, that could be a very useful meditation.
picture better time is kind of an illusion. Like, I can understand it, but at the same time, there's a disappointment that comes along with that, of just feeling also disappointed.
So, yeah, a grief. Yes, no, I really do understand that. The question was regarding giving up the future. She could understand how, you know, looking for some better future all the time creates the kind of tension, but there also is a disappointment that comes in giving up the future, because and in some ways we have to play out that strategy of living futuristically, living not for today but for, until the grief of letting it go pales by comparison to the joy of having the moment, of regaining the moment. Because every time we do put ourselves, project ourselves forward in time, we give up the basis of where our life really is. And what we're trying to do is to maximize and regain a foothold into where we're actually alive. And at first it seems like it's depleting our life to do such a thing. And after a while, because you will have base camped yourself there for a while, you begin to see the relevance of doing it. Right now, you may not see the relevance to do it because you're still hooked into, you're young, you have probably a lot of ideas about how you'll go and what your life is going to be about. And it seems like it's depriving you of that to come back into the moment. But do it for the course of these weeks. So you'll get some sense. It may not be now, but at some time in your life, you'll think, oh, wait a second, I see what the pain is here. I see why this is creating the kind of tension, even though it keeps me very excited and enthusiastic. Oftentimes, the reality is what's being missed, and for that enthusiasm, and the enthusiasm never really shows its for self in the present, because I'm always thinking about the next enthusiastic thing to, you see, so the enthusiasm comes into the present, it's missed, and where our eyes are then looking over the horizon for the next, you see.
Right. It's kind of funny, one of the thoughts that sometimes have when I hear about, you know, it sounds so great sometimes, you know, just really being present. One day in the future, I'm really going to be in the present.
Right. One day in the future, I'm really going to be in the present. Right, exactly. That's what we do for our whole life. And it's important to understand that the present moment is not all that exciting and enticing. It's not like it's, you know, oh, I've got it now, you know. Really, it's kind of ordinary. Well, it is ordinary. It's just what it is. And we keep being disturbed by the ordinary and try to create an extraordinary sense of this by projecting, you know, a glitter on the horizon. But missing everything. So if we go through the ordinary into stillness, the ordinary is the ordinary. It's okay. I mean, I can feel the emotions, and it's okay. It doesn't, you know, it's not. But then, in being able to hold the ordinary, it suddenly changes into the extraordinary, because it's no longer held within the conceptual frame of ordinariness. When we really own it, it suddenly has a mystery or a wonder to it. It's not a wonder like, wonder where I am. It's a wonder of everything is new. It's like being on a different planet, but knowing everything on that planet at the same time. And that has an amazing capacity to enliven the heart, the sense of wonder. So it's not just being stuck with, oh, now here, okay, well, I'm stuck with just being me. Because as soon as we really are in the present, me is not me anymore. You know? Yes. This moment is enormous and it's all we have. Yes. Yes. It's all we've ever had. It's all we've ever had. It's important to understand that. It's all we have ever had. We have lived our lives in fantasy away from it, but it's all that we've ever had. And we spend very little time here, because here represents pain to us. It means when we are here that we have to be accountable to the pain that has created the very need to be somewhere else. The pain of my self-dislike, the pain of my loneliness. And we think, I've anything but that, so I'll just keep creating futures in which, you know, I won't be lonely, I'll be with it. And yet we come back, we have to go through all those layers of pain, we come back and we feel them, and we have the capacity to hold them, we don't have to run from them as we thought we always did. And when we have the capacity to hold them, each concentric circle opens up wider and wider to new arenas of freedom and spaciousness. And we have been confined within those concentric circles of our pain and the resistance we have to them, and suddenly it's like walking into an open field. Wow, this is amazing. Other questions or comments? Yes.
A lot of my thinking is visual. And I know you talked a lot about descriptive thinking.
Is there a way to handle visual images? You handle them in exactly the same way. Any image you just create, you take as thought. And so when you have a lot of images, you know, you see things very vividly in your mind. Just release yourself from those images. Or what you can do is know you're seeing those images. And knowing you're seeing, you're then meditating upon the image, you might say. You see? Know you're having those images. Know what, so you don't let the image take you out, take you away, unconscious to unconscious paths of, right? You know you're, okay, I can be aware of this. In fact, just as you're looking now, just be aware of what you're seeing. So you know you're seeing. What you're seeing. Now you're not seeing person. You're seeing color and shape. The mind is putting person on it, but that's not really what the eyes are seeing. The eyes are seeing color and form. So when you see, just let your eyes be very soft if you want to be mindfully seeing. Just let your eyes be soft. Look around and just see color and shape. Very soft. And know what you're seeing. So there it is. Mindfulness of seeing. Mindfulness can come at any door. Question is about content. Is it possible to live your life without content? No, it's not possible to live your life without content because you wouldn't be able to find your way back home. Right? And so the mind and its thinking has a purpose, has a point to it. You have to navigate all of this. So it can inform, right? Okay, I need to get back home. So I get in my car. Okay, I know how to get back home. You don't have to work on it. It's just there. But it doesn't have to. What happens is that that's not where thought stops. It keeps going. It says, I've got to get home and I've got to watch fill in the blank on TV. Tuesday night football or whatever. And so no, it's not just, and it's that tension comes not from the thoughts informing us about the purposes of navigation or functionality, which we all have to have, but it directs our lives. And we don't even realize that that came mostly from an emotion, you know. It's like a sense of wanting came in terms of a TV show, and for around that sense of wanting, suddenly a whole anxiety and fear of not having. And then an elaboration on that to the point where it raises the decibel of the tension level, and you're driving not being informed at all, but just thinking about how you've got to get back to see your TV program. So it's to come back to sanity and let thought inform us in the way it needs to inform us and let the other thought go. And that's a very tricky thing because we believe, mostly, that the thought is telling us the truth, and it's not. It's just been our perception, misperception. And we just said it, if you were born, and I told you on the day you were born, and then followed you until the year right now and said, I'm no good, you're no good, you're no good. Every day, you're no good. Get up, I'm no good. Eat, I'm no good. And then you sit down and come to a meditation class, what do you think you're going to, what's going to come out of there? Wow, I'm really feeling fine about myself. No. It's, what's going to come out of there is what we've put in, and what is coming out of there now is what we've put in. Doesn't that just make sense? So that's been insane because we didn't have any reference for putting that material in back then. We just put it in because the world was chaotic and that's what we assumed our place in chaos was. When you're small, you have no power. You have nothing. You don't even have any... People are treating you from their own, you know, all of that. So the child of the past comes out in meditation. So here we are, and we... But it comes out... But you see, we can... The child of the past needs to be honored. Okay, the feelings, the resurrection of the cries and screams of where I've come from. Yeah, those are all there. But I have the capacity to hold those now, and I never did before. Because I can feel it. It's a feeling. It's a feeling and a thought. It's not a representation of an embodiment. It's a feeling and a thought. And a memory. Memory, feeling, thought, emotion. Okay, it, every one of those is very doable. Doable, 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 doable. Okay. It's just when it gets packaged in an embodiment. Oh, I'm so. There you've embodied it. There's no I'm. What's I'm? Where is the I'm in a memory? Where is the I'm in a thought or in a emotion? If each of those things is just a neuron firing, where's the I in a neuron firing? Time magazine certainly a periodical of very ordinary middle of the road thinking had this. I pulled it out because it was on the physiology of the brain or something, and there was a paragraph that says, scientists have been looking for an entity for 100 years and have not been able to find one in any part of the brain. There's no entity. There's no me. It's a constellation of different processes, like you're stringing popcorn, right? A single pipe, but you string them and then you have a garland. We've strung all these processes together to form me. And if we come back to it just being the process of mind, rather than the definition or the conclusion of those processes, we come back to being who we are, which is a totally authentic human being. Human being. Nothing's missing. No eccentricity, like weirdness. Challenging, yep. Questioning, yep. But I know how to say thank you and please. Without the tension. Without the tension. You give up nothing, you gain everything. And the fear says you give up everything and gain nothing. That's what fear will always say. It will say the reverse of what is true. That's its job. To keep you bound in the top 3 inches of your body. So just don't listen to it. Thoughts are not worth... Nothing honorable comes from that. They're just not worth listening to, really. I don't believe him. I don't believe him. I know that. Okay. I don't know what brought you here, but check it out for yourself, because it's not about believing me. It's looking and seeing the truth. Is this true? Is this true? Shall we end with a metta? See how down to earth this practice is? I'm not asking you to astral travel, leave your body. This is here. The Buddha touched the earth. It's here, right? I love the fact that it's that ground, the ground of sanity. Right here. This is where the freedom lies. This is where the heart is alive. So let the heart relax. Be at peace with itself. May I be safe and free from danger. May I be free of fear. May I have ease and well-being. Don't you want that for yourself? If your mind says you don't, which one are you going to believe? You're going to believe the mind? Oh, I don't deserve that. When are we going to stop believing that? I don't care what the mind says. May I be free and from danger. May I have ease and well-being. And now let the heart open so that you share the wealth of that affection with other beings as well. So all beings, may all beings be safe and free of danger. May all beings be free of fear. May all beings have ease and well-being. Because the heart wishes it. That's all. Not whether it's a reachable goal, or just the heart wishes it. For myself and for all beings. Let us acknowledge once more the stillness, the quiet. Let's not acknowledge it as something happening to us. But something much more intimate than that. An expression of us. Feel it. Feel it in the room. May all beings be safe and free of danger. May all beings be free of fear. May all beings have ease and well-being. At the end of the meditation, I choose to bow. I choose to bow for many reasons. Because it's a humbling experience to see your mind and how much there is in it and how difficult it can be. And to be humble to it is really the right orientation. And to acknowledge the work that all of us are doing together. I acknowledge that in my bow. And the fact that I bow to something greater than this particular mind and body sense of me and mine, and the acknowledgement and growth that I'm moving into that, that we are moving, expanding outward in our definition of who we are. And I acknowledge and bow to all of that as well. If you feel comfortable, and only if you feel comfortable, you can join me in that or not. So thank you for coming. If you would remember the Dana basket, I would be deeply appreciative, and I'll see you all next week. And don't forget to save October 26th, Saturday, for the day long.